Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. This program is part of Evolve 2009, a San Francisco citywide celebration of the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin and the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. I'm Brian Hackney, science editor at CBS 5, and bearer of an autographed picture by somebody who used to be an amateur astronomer, an autographed picture of Clyde Tombaugh. In 1930, Clyde discovered what came to be known as the planet Pluto. At least it was Pluto until our guest tonight sent it spinning out of the International Astronomical Union's nomenclature. And we can't say that Neil deGrasse Tyson single-handedly demoted Pluto, but he certainly didn't do anything to stop it. In his new book, The Pluto Files, Dr. Tyson documents how Pluto went from planet to Plutoid and how his life was changed forever as a result. So was Dr. Tyson's, by the way. A reminder, by the way, that we will be taking questions from the audience after the talk, and it is worth noting that on page 139 of this book, that Dr. Tyson regards Californians as looking and behaving a bit odd. Let's not disappoint him. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to introduce astrophysicist, author, director of the Hayden Planetarium, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Thank you. By the way, one of my favorite lines from Clyde Tombaugh is, he's the discoverer of Pluto. He was 24 years old when he discovered it, by the way. And you'd always show pictures of Pluto, and how do you do that? Well, in the old days, you didn't have Hubble. Not that Hubble does a very good job at it today anyway, because it's so far away and so little, it's just a smudge, okay? So you look at a star field, and one of these dots is Pluto. But how are you going to know which dot is? So the little arrow on it. So they asked him, so you put an arrow so you can find out which one it is. So people always ask him, when you discovered Pluto, how did you know which one it was? He said, well, it had the arrow. It was like, it's obvious which one Pluto is. So, anyhow, I realize this is for radio, so if I show you stuff, no one on the radio will know. So I can't show you anything. I have to describe it with great precision. I'm just emptying my pockets now. Just so I can... Sorry. I should have done this beforehand. I apologize. There. That feels better. So, where shall we begin? At the beginning? All right. I don't know. All right, here we go. It was the late 1990s. Back in New York City, we knew that something needed to be done about the Hayden Planetarium. Its attendance was dropping while the attendance in the rest of the institution was rising. So something was wrong. It was old. It was in need of repair, in need of a facelift, in need of a rethinking of how we do the universe. And so we raised $200 million to completely rebuild the entire facility. We realized that if we're going to spend that much money, you want to get it as right as possible, okay? You don't want to cut metal and then a few weeks later find out something new has to be added or subtracted. Or at least the parts for which you cut metal, you want that to be science of high shelf life, okay? So we realized, well, how are we going to present the solar system? Just a couple of years earlier, icy objects were found orbiting beyond Neptune, orbiting in a zone that Pluto occupied. By the way, these objects were predicted to be there at mid-century by an astronomer theorist named Gerard Kuiper. He was based, I forgot where he was based. It's in the book. I have it correctly in the book. I can make something up now, but it's in the book. So Gerard Kuiper was a brilliant theorist. He hypothesized that beyond the orbit of the farthest most large object, Neptune, that if there's no large planet out there, nothing to gravitationally vacuum up the material that would form a planet in the first place, then the material would still be out there, a kind of a debris leftover zone. And so, but no one had a telescope powerful enough to determine this until the 1990s. The Keck telescope, largest optical telescope in the world, was brought to bear on this problem. And they started finding icy bodies in the outer solar system, just as predicted to be there. So we looked at this and said, well, wait a minute. Pluto, as odd as it is, if you think of it as a planet, look at the properties of these icy bodies in the outer solar system. They're kind of small, like Pluto. They're kind of icy, like Pluto. They have orbits that are kind of odd. They have orbits that cross the orbit of Neptune, like Pluto. They have orbits that are tipped out of the plane of the solar system, like Pluto. So maybe Pluto wasn't just simply an oddball planet. Maybe Pluto is a normal version of this new species of object found in the outer solar system. So what we did was, instead of enumerate planets panel at a time, we said, let's group objects in the solar system by like properties. So we took Pluto and said, Pluto, we're going to group you with all your brethren, your newly discovered brethren in the outer solar system. Gas giants, we're going to make a photo, a family photo of you guys as well. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. They're large, gaseous, low density. So low density that, in fact, Saturn would float on water. That's how low density Saturn is. When I was a kid, I knew this. I always wanted a rubber Saturn rather than a rubber ducky in my bathtub. Okay? There's a marketing opportunity there. I just want to let you know. All right? For the geek set who know you're a geek when you're still playing with rubber ducks in the bathtub. So where was I before I interrupted myself? Family photo. Thank you. So we have the family photo of the gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. They have more in common with each other than any one of them has with anything else. That's kind of like what you'd want to make a family photo. We grouped the rocky, smaller objects together, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. The asteroid belt, put them together, and there you have it. That's all we did. That's what we did. So when you came to the center, we opened in 2000, you would see sort of the gas giants grouped together. You'd see the rocky, smaller planets there, and that was an exhibit on size. You'd have to go to another place to look at the solar system, and you saw all of the groups, all of them there. The Kuiper belt, what's now known as the Kuiper belt, the asteroid belt, the gas giant. That's what we did. Well, a year later, took a whole year, there was a New York Times reporter, apparently on vacation, visiting the facility, walking nut, and then he overhears a conversation between a mother and son. Mother and son. The son, young son, looking, Mommy, where's Pluto? It's there somewhere, just keep looking. Mommy, where's Pluto? Keep looking. Mommy, where's Pluto? Shut up already, I'm sure it's there. Finally, she came over, looked for Pluto, couldn't find Pluto. It wasn't there. Then she had to confirm it wasn't there, she had to recite the mnemonic just to make sure she didn't miss anyone, right? My very educated mother just served us 9 pizzas. And so she went, she got the 4 Rockies, she got to the 4 giants, and then the P at the end was missing. And so she confirmed her son's conclusion that Pluto was missing. The reporter overheard this. Said, I got a story here. Called it up, called into the headquarters, New York Times headquarters in Times Square. That's how Times Square got its name, by the way. The New York Times was based in Times Square. It's not just a coincidence. So So they've actually moved. The Times, New York Times headquarters now moved out of Times Square a couple of blocks away. But Disney's like all over, so it could be like Disney Square now. You know, that's how that... We'll get back to Disney in a few moments. So he calls it... So brings in the science reporter with the photographer, and they study this problem. And it took them a year... Not a year to do it, but it took a year to get noticed about how we organize the solar system. And then came the page one story on the New York Times. This was on January 22nd, 2001. Now, what should be filling that page that day? Let's think. What happened 2 days before that? The inauguration of President George W. Okay? You'd think the whole front page would be filled with articles related to the transition of power, especially since they were still counting dimpled chads in Florida, okay? But no. So here's the New York Times, and I have a mock-up of that very paper right here, okay? This is it. New York Times, January 22nd, 2001. So yes, on the first day, Bush settles into his refitted Oval Office. Okay, so it's there. I don't have a problem with that. Over here, 37 new cardinals selected by the Pope. Okay, big news. Okay. Iraqi rebuilt weapons factories, U.S. officials say. Okay, interesting to see news before, you know, what's called the truth at the time you read it. That's kind of interesting. Turn around. We got new power plants in California because there were brownouts coming through here. We needed that. I guess that's good news right there. But here it is at the bottom. Pluto not a planet? Only in New York. Okay? There it is. Right there. Page freaking one. Page one. We didn't say Pluto wasn't a planet. We just grouped it with its newly found family. That's all we did. So, when does this hit? In the morning, this title came out. By that afternoon, my phone couldn't stop ringing. Within 4 days, I was getting hate mail from third graders, okay? This created a disturbance in the space-time continuum of the elementary school curriculum. So, my life would never be the same as my file cabinets burgeoned with people choosing sides on this issue. People angry. Pissed off is really the right word. In the Pluto files, I've got some letters are transcribed, but others, I had to just scan them in because they're like seven-year-old kids, crayon scrawled notices. Dear Dr. Tyson, put Pluto back. It's my favorite planet. Here's what it looks like. And it drew a picture of it in case I didn't know what it looked like. All right? Another one said, "It write back soon, but not in cursive. I don't know how to read cursive yet." It was the cutest thing. Just so cute. It's just too cute. Completely too cute. So this went on for years. People choosing up sides. And I try to understand, why do Americans care so? Because in Europe, they don't care. You say Pluto may be demoted. They say, oh, but of course, you know, or pass the wine. Fine, what else is new? You know, nobody's getting bent out of shape. Nobody has emotional disruption by this information. So I thought about this. I said, well, 1930, Pluto's discovered. What else happened in 1930? What else happened in 1930? Of course, that's the year that Disney first sketched the dog. The dog. Pluto, the dog, has the same tenure in the hearts and minds of Americans as does the cosmic object. They are the same age. Plus, an American discovered Pluto. You combine all this, this is a recipe for, like, emotional attachments. Plus, when do you first learn about the planets? It's in early elementary school. And if you're a normal kid, you'd be like watching cartoons too, all right? So here you are there, and you're not learning about the Roman mythology that gave you that. You get that's later, like in sixth grade, seventh grade. They're just names. Mercury, first time you hear it. Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto. And so, bam, there it is. There's the emotional attachment, never to be extricated again from your hearts and your minds. And so I'm convinced that's the reason. I have no other accounting for it at all. And so, because it's diminutive, there are seven moons in the solar system bigger than Pluto. Did you know this? I don't know if you knew that. Okay. And including Earth's moon. By the way, I came through here. This is like my second time in this room. I came through it 2 years ago when I had my previous book came out. And I hadn't planned on going there, but I was asked about Pluto by the audience. And I was giving sort of an update of what was going on at the time. But what I could not have said was, since our decision to reorganize Pluto, it was the first public institution to take that stand. The professional community realized that something has to be done about Pluto. It's too different from the rest of the objects we traditionally call planets to lay quiet while these discoveries are going on. So they set up a planet naming committee to look into the problem. Top people looking into the problem. So they proposed that Pluto still be called a planet, and then a planet just simply be anything that's round. That pretty much will get you Pluto. You get Pluto out of that one. Other folks said, uh-uh, nope, nope, we don't play that. We gotta, if you're just round, then what good is that? I have other objections as well, but it started out where we gotta do a little better than just, is it round? So, two extra criteria were added to justify planet status. Mind you, we never redefined the word planet. We just didn't care to use the word at all. But now they're trying to come up with a new definition of the word planet. So, are you round? Put a check in Pluto's box. Next, are you the predominant member in orbit around the sun? So that's code for, are you somebody's moon, okay? Pluto is not somebody's moon. Pluto has a moon, Charon, it's called, okay? So Pluto goes around, Charon, C-H-A-R-O-N. It's not just because, like, somebody's wife was named Charon or anything. not that you asked, but since we're here together, planets are named after Roman gods. Planet moons are named after Greek characters in the life of the Greek counterpart to that Roman god. Got that? Okay, so for example, one of Jupiter's moons is Ganymede. Ganymede is the manservant of Zeus, and Zeus is the counterpart to Jupiter. So this is an homage to the Greek and Roman history of the subject. There is one, so Charon is the name of the ferry boat driver to take your unfortunate soul across the river into Hades. Yeah, see, we got that figured out. We got that, there you go. There's one planet that is an exception to this. That's the planet Uranus. Its moons are named after assorted characters in Shakespearean literature. Shakespeare. Someone said, why? Thank you. I wonder if anyone's going to just say why. Or you're just going to just accept it as, oh, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, okay. Thank you, ma'am. You said why. Uranus was the very first planet ever discovered. Nobody had discovered a planet before. It was discovered by William Herschel of the United Kingdom, England, okay? William Herschel discovers a planet. If you've never discovered a planet before, there's no tradition of how to name them. These have just been named from antiquity. So he said, I discovered a planet, I'm going to name it. So he did what any good scientist would do. He named it after his principal funder, which was King George. So for about 50 years, if you looked at the enumeration of planets in textbooks, it was Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and George. Okay? Now, I don't know about you, but I would take issue. There's something wrong with a planet named George. Right? I don't know about you, but I don't want a planet named George. So now, how do you resolve this? Because the British are the most powerful nation the world had ever seen, politically, culturally, economically. So you got to appease them somehow. So you said, all right, give us back the planet name, and we'll allow you to name the moons after fictional characters in the writings of your most famous author. So that's how that came out. And so the moons of Uranus are Miranda, Puck, Oberon, Portia, these sorts of things. If you're completely illiterate, those are characters in Shakespeare, okay? Just in case you didn't know, I didn't want to, just so you know. Okay, that was like a whole diversion there, but I get that off my chest. So, now where did I leave off? Checking to see if you're paying attention. What are the criteria? Oh, it's the check boxes. Yeah, thank you. Somebody was paying attention on the left-hand side here. So, check, is it round? Yes. Are you the principal orbiter? Yes. Third one, have you cleared your orbit of debris? Not Pluto. It is orbiting the sun with countless other frozen bodies in the outer solar system. There you have it. It is not even the largest of them. In the last 10 years, we found two, one that sort of rivals it in size. Another one is definitely bigger than it. Eris, it's called. There's Sedna and Eris, challenging Pluto for the status of the biggest ice ball in the outer solar system. So, by the way, so if you don't satisfy these three criteria, if any one of them is not satisfied, sorry, if all three have to be satisfied in order to be a planet, if you're round, a principal object, and haven't cleared your orbit, then you're a dwarf planet. So two out of three checks get you the dwarf status. All right? That elevated one of the asteroids. The biggest asteroid is called Ceres, C-E-R-E-S. It's round. But where is it found? The asteroid belt, littered with debris. Yeah, yeah. So that one's not a planet. It's a dwarf planet. Then they said, all right, we got to make Pluto a little happier than this. So why don't we make a new subclassification? If you are round, haven't cleared your orbit, but you're icy and orbit beyond Neptune, then you're a Plutoid. Pluto is then the benchmark of this new class of icy body in the outer solar system. And Ceres would not be a Plutoid. Ceres is, once again, a Roman god, named the goddess of harvest. And Ceres is the root word to the word cereal. How did an asteroid get the name of a Roman god? Because when it was first discovered, it was thought to be a planet orbiting between Mars and Jupiter. Big news, discovered a new planet. And then they kept looking, then they found another planet, and then another, and then another. They found four in a row, named them all, Ceres, Pallas, Vesta, Juno. Then they kept, they said, wait a minute, pause, these are kind of little. And holy cow, there's like dozens of them. There's hundreds of them. There's thousands of them. So they said, maybe we've discovered a new swath of real estate in the solar system rather than just some planet hangout. And so if you look at textbooks from 1801 up through 1850, the planet count went up, got as high as 17, 18, 19. You didn't know that. Get a book in 1845, there are 17 planets in the solar system. Then the numbers got out of hand. They said, we've discovered something new. They're not planets. They're something else. Thus became the asteroid belt. So we've kind of been down this road before. So Pluto was just simply the first object discovered of a new swath of real estate in the outer solar system, the Kuiper Belt. And that's where it now stands. And that's where we... So what the Plutophiles is... Oh, by the way, I feel strongly... I don't care what the definition of the word planet is. I really don't. But if it's going to be everything that's round, I submit to you that that's just not useful. If Pluto is in the same category as Jupiter, and I say, oh, I just discovered a planet, then you have to ask, well, is it big? Is it small? Is it gaseous? Is it rocky? Does it have rings? Is it in the habitable zone? If we have to play 20 questions after I say I just discovered a planet, the word planet is not useful to you. I can tell you, oh, could you pull that book off the shelf? Could you pull that dictionary off the shelf? Could you pull that encyclopedia off the shelf? Could you pull that pamphlet off the shelf? Could you pull that paperback off the shelf? Each one of those words means something to you, and you will not pull one that's not that off the shelf when I ask it of you. I don't say, pull the paper product off the shelf. So what we need is a lexicon that properly captures the depth of knowledge we now have acquired of these cosmic objects. Because the word planet was fine when all you knew was that they were just sort of wanderers against the background sky as they were defined in ancient Greece. Planet comes from the word planetes, wanderer. There were seven wanderers in the night sky, unambiguously defined. Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, and the Moon. Those objects would move throughout the year against the background sky. Nothing else moved. You got seven planets. Bada bing. There it is. No arguments. Those then became the names for the 7 days of the week, drawn from Roman and Norse mythology. So Saturn would be Saturday, the sun is Sunday, the moon is Monday, that sort of thing. So Copernicus comes along, puts the sun in the middle instead of Earth. Earth then becomes in orbit around the sun, commensurate with these other things we had been calling planets. The moon comes into orbit the Earth. So we lost two planets and gained one. So after Copernicus, there were six planets and not seven. But a planet then was just, did you go around the sun? Okay, that was it. Wasn't much else to talk about. Wasn't much else interesting to say. Telescope hadn't been invented yet. This year, the 400th anniversary of the telescope, benighted the International Year of Astronomy because of this. So all I can say is that now we've been to the planets. We've orbited them. We've plunged probes into their gaseous envelopes. We've orbited their moons. We've had rovers on them. So much to talk about. And if all you can do is lead with the statement, is it a planet or not, I submit that that is no longer scientifically or pedagogically interesting. And so while I'm here pontificating to you, all my pontifications are reserved for only the last chapter of the Pluto Files, where it says advice to teachers, parents, and students. The rest of the book is just a celebration of this love affair, irrational though it looked to me. And I'll give an example of this irrationality, and then we'll break for questions. Do you have a copy of the book there? May I use it? Thank you. Oops, sorry. For you people on the radio, I'm reaching for my book across the way. Here you go. Hello, everyone on the radio. How are you? So in the book, oh, just so you know, I'm turning to page 111. And on 111 is the very first letter sent by a seven-year-old kid. It's the very first letter. This is the one where he drew the picture of Pluto on the back page here. It's the cutest thing. Dear Natural History Museum, you are missing planet Pluto. Please make a model of it. This is what it looks like. It is a planet. Love, Will Galmont. A picture of Pluto by Will Galmont. I am 7 years old. That's so cute. It's so cute. And others from... I have other letters here that are not as G-rated. But that's what the sort of the at sign, the number sign, and the exclamation point are for when you are communicating non-G-rated content. I'll tell you two more things, and we'll go to Q&A. One of my favorite comics, and my very favorite comic in here, because I put comics in here and humor pieces. My favorite comic is by Chaz Allman, where he's got a personified orb of Pluto on a street corner holding a beggar's cup, and there's a sign in front of him that says, victim of downsizing. Poor Pluto. There's an article written for The Onion. You know The Onion. We all know The Onion. We've got to love The Onion. There's an article there. They're fake news articles, right? So this one said, NASA decides to send a consolar probe to Pluto to alert it. And it's filled with all this sort of office politics speak, like office psychology speak. Well, the probe is designed to arrive on a Friday rather than a Monday. So it has the weekend to recover from this news. And lastly, forgive me, but Appendix H is, which I referenced earlier in the book, but the entire contents of it is here in Appendix H. California, what state are we? California? California legislation relative to Pluto's planetary status. California Assembly Bill. Was it H.R. 56, relative to Pluto's planetary status, introduced by Assembly members Keith Richmond, M.D., Republican, District 38, and Joseph Canciamila, Democrat, District 11. So it's bipartisan legislation here. Whereas, it's got all the whereas speak, so you know it's real. Whereas recent astronomical discoveries, including Pluto's oblong orbit, and the sighting of a slightly larger Kuiper Belt object have led astronomers to question the planetary status of Pluto. Fine, a little bit of science there. Whereas mean-spirited scientists decided to disrespect Pluto by stripping Pluto of its planetary status and reclassifying as a low... This is your tax money at work. I just want you to know. Whereas Pluto, named after the Roman god of the underworld, and affectionately sharing the name of California's most famous animated dog, have special connection to California history and culture. I don't mean to, like, get on your case here, but if an animated dog is a fundamental part of your history and culture... I don't know what that means. I don't know. So this goes on and on. And my favorite one here, and I'll end on this. No, I can't. No, I can't even read that. See, if I don't read it, then that, like, you'll have to buy the book, right? So there's method here. So, all right. Fine. Whereas the downgrading of Pluto reduces the number of planets available for legislative leaders to hide redistricting legislation and other inconvenient political reform measures, and resolved by the Assembly of the State of California that the Assembly hereby condemns the International Astronomical Union's decision to strip Pluto of its planet status, and for its tremendous impact on the people of California and the state's long-term fiscal health. Anyhow, it's all here. It's all here. Pluto. Oh, that was Southern California. Oh, I forgot. That's true. Disneyland is Southern California. That's right. I forgot about that. I'm sorry. So anyway, so thanks for your attention. It's just a little, it's just fun with Pluto. That's all the book is. And so thank you.
We're going to take a moment to remind the radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Hayden Planetarium Director Neil deGrasse Tyson about Pluto and other things extraterrestrial. And I'm going to begin the questioning just by saying, Dr. Tyson, isn't it true that 10 years ago, in another book that you wrote, you came out in favor of Pluto retaining its planetary status?
Let me explain. some years ago, I wrote a book called Merlin's Tour of the Universe, written entirely in the pen name of Merlin. So, in fact, it was Merlin who made that decision, not I. No, that was at a time... Merlin is a different character. It's a Q&A book on the universe, real questions from the real public. It was my very first book, actually, and I'm happy to say it's still in print. And if you're really a science newbie, then that book is for you. It'll take you right from... handhold you right through the beginning of our understanding of the cosmos. And in there, I got asked, what is Pluto? How do you feel about Pluto? And Merlin replied, well, Pluto's got a moon, you know? And if you got a moon, well, sure, you got to be a planet. That was, of course, before the first Kuiper Belt object was discovered. Had that information been available, Merlin may have given a different answer. But I still claim that I'm not responsible because that was a pen name and not...
Okay. By the way, I want to remind the audience that in sort of a departure from what we usually do at the Commonwealth Club, we've got microphones throughout the audience on either side of the aisle. So if you do want to step up and if you have a question, we welcome you to do that. We're also relying on the usual cards that we get from the audience. Let me just ask you, though.
I answer questions better when I stand. Do you mind if I do that?
Do whatever you...
Just sit seated. I feel like I should be listening to somebody else if I'm...
We're
seated.
Here for you.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, whatever makes you comfortable.
Good.
I do have to ask you that the morning that you went to the bottom fold of the New York Times and saw that New York had apparently single-handedly changed the designation of Pluto, did you get a call from your boss?
Yes. Yes, the provost of the American Museum of Natural History, the highest ranking academic officer, called me that day. And I was relatively young and newly hired at the institution, and the institution cares about its reputation, doesn't want to get the science wrong or bad, because that would disrupt its long-earned, well-earned reputation. He said, Neil, what have you done? Did you do this alone? We actually had a committee of my colleagues, and we got together. So first, it was not alone. Second, I said, no, it's just where it's got to go. It's what it's got to be. And he didn't believe. He called other professionals in the field, one of whom was an astrophysicist and provost at Princeton University. His name is Jerry Ostreicher, highly decorated astrophysicist, who also happens to know me because I postdoced at Princeton. Okay? So, called him up and said, what do we make of this? And he said, whatever Neil says, that's correct. And so that was fine. So it was hard for the administration to accept this because we were being raked over the coals. But then, 6 years later, the international community votes in our favor. And 4 years later, when a bigger object was found than Pluto, the New York Times ran an editorial saying, maybe we should rethink the Pluto situation. Then it said, 4 years ago, the Hayden Planetarium created quite a stir. I'm thinking, no, we didn't. You did. Sorry, I'm screaming up here. So they acquiesced 4 years after this, and then the vote was 2 years later when the professional community voted in favor of something being done with Pluto. So we were basically right all along. And I don't want to claim special deep cosmic insight here. We were just about to spend $200 million. If you're going to do that, you're going to do your homework. And we had the occasion to do our homework before anybody else did. And that's really all that went on there.
If this planetary brouhaha had taken place at the Griffith Observatory, if you were the director of the California Academy of Sciences, would Pluto still be a planet today?
You worried about the
center of the universe, New York City, yes.
Are you wondering about the Disney influence? Or
possibly.
Possibly.
Is it just because it happened in New York that finally, in August of 2006, the IAU said, well, you know what, okay, Pluto's not a planet.
Well, I was so angry with all the bad publicity. I felt like, why don't I just go along with it and say, yep, we kick Pluto out. Too small to make it in New York. Yep. I felt like, give him something to argue about. Get me started.
Let's take a question from the audience, the lady on my left, anyway.
Yes.
A while back, I read Thomas Kuhn's Nature of Scientific Revolutions, I think it was called.
The Structure of Scientific
Structure
Revolutions.
Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And your experience with Pluto seemed very common to a lot of things that other scientists have gone through. And I was just wondering if you kind of can expound on that at all, if you think this is an experience like what happened when we figured out that electricity wasn't a fluid or something like that.
Okay, so the book she's referring to is a highly influential book on the philosophy of science and the history of science. It's written by a physicist-turned-philosopher, Thomas Kuhn, highly influential, and it's what really brought the word paradigm into common parlance, where you have a scientific paradigm, where everybody kind of believes something because that's the right thing to believe at the time. And then some new data comes along, and then you got to all believe this. Now, it's been widely misunderstood and misinterpreted to think that scientists just sort of have a temporary truth that they sort of hang out with. Okay, we're done with that, now let's go hang out with this truth, as though there's no convergence, and it's just false. Not only that, there are great discoveries that don't undermine what was known before. There are plenty of discoveries that no one knew anything about, And so you didn't have to rethink something that happened before. Whereas if you only took your science understanding from that book, you would think we're always in the process of an upheaval of a paradigm that we were clutching to with our nails. So with Pluto, here's how you need to think about it. Not that Pluto used to be a planet, now it's not. That's the wrong attitude. And you have that attitude because you learned it as a memorization of a sequence of names. Had planets been taught differently, for example, these are rocky and these are icy and this is that, then you wouldn't have this issue. So it's how it was taught more than what the science was. And so, and I take some blame for that because I'm an educator and my brethren write books that actually presented it that way. So we need a new, if it's a paradigm shift, it's in the education of the public, not in the science of it. So think of Pluto not as the discovery of the ninth planet. Think of it as the discovery of a new kind of object in the solar system. So in that regard, the science has grown in its understanding, not shifted from the left to the right and up and down and front and back. It's a new, bigger understanding of the same system of planets. That's how we think about it.
And now let's take a question from the gentleman on my right.
Dr. Tyson, as you well know, in 1630s, Galileo was threatened with considerably more than simply a bill in the California House, where he was threatened with death or execution simply for upsetting the paradigm of the time. Would you like to reflect a bit on that?
Sure. The paradigm at the time was that Earth was the center of all motion, that and that first it looks that way. So we can't really completely fault the church for dogmatism there. If you stand on Earth, it kind of looks that way. So, but it greatly resonated with Scripture. If you look at Genesis, basically Earth is there in the middle, and there was no way to interpret Genesis any other way if you're looking at the literal meaning of those passages. And everybody who read those passages read it that way until science showed that the sun is in the middle. Okay, so there, you can't completely blame it because it actually looked that way. The problem is, it's not that you had one paradigm and then another. The problem is, if your belief system is, according to you, incapable of error, then it becomes dogma. And so, by the way, you can have scientific dogma. That's what happened in Russia with Lysenko. All right? Lysenko was the guy who said that you can inherit characteristics acquired by your parents, okay, rather than sort of genetically part of your thread. And so that was so, that resonated so well with sort of Marxist philosophy of the day that wrong scientific understanding of biology became political dogma. And so, and you need to always be flexible to a modification of what you know. Otherwise, you get in a rut, or you can, particularly if you have power of authority to punish people for believing differently, that's a recipe for disaster. So this is different. This, at least there was an open dialogue. People chose up sides, and in the end, people are looking for data. The informed folks are looking for data. Others are still sort of emotionally want it one way rather than another, and I don't think you can ever switch that out. I can tell you this. Third graders today, the hate mail has stopped. They were born into the awareness that Pluto was demoted. And so they're just saying, yeah, it's eight planets. Eight planets. Just ask them. Ask any of them. Eight planets. And the third graders from 2001, they're all now in high school with hormonal priorities that prevent them from caring about this problem. So those who are so entrenched in it, they'll grow old and die. The next generation will understand it from scratch.
Which brings us to the question, you know, in the old days we had nine planets. Now we've got the terrestrial, the rocky planets, the gas giants, and the Kuiper Belt objects?
I know, it's weak. It's weak. And plus, astronomers are good at finding cool names for things.
Yeah.
Right? Beginning of the universe, Big Bang, right? You got that? Big red stars, red giants. We're pretty good about naming things. Kuiper Belt objects is just kind of weak.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I'd like to call them snow cones or something, you know. I don't know. I'm a little embarrassed by it.
Well, is there something official that we're going to, did the IAU say, this is what we're calling it, or is it still in flux?
KBOs, Kuiper Belt objects.
Is that right?
Yeah, KBOs, that's what they are. Or trans-Neptunian objects. That's worse. Plus, since trans doesn't even use the word right, they're actually ultra-Neptunian, which means trans means across rather than beyond. So it's bad English prefix put into a bad name. Yeah. That's in here, too. He's just, I'm all over it.
Okay.
Here. All over it.
But is that your advice? One of our questions from the audience has to do with you're a science teacher, maybe you're teaching seventh grade. What do you tell students now?
Well, see, I could tell you that or just tell you to buy the frickin' book, because in the last chapter, that's why I write the book, so I don't have to tell. I can go back home, you know? That's why, let me get the title of the chapter here. Okay, it's Pluto's Judgment Day, that's that. And then Pluto, the dwarf planet, there it goes. And then, wait, hang on, and then Pluto in the elementary school classroom. A personal recommendation for educators. And there's a comic that appeared. It says, science class, we've got a whole new, what does that say? So, no planet left behind. This is a comic. At the time, only the round criterion was all the buzz. Without the clearing the orbit, that would have brought in another 7 objects in the solar system. So this is no planet left behind, and lists them all from Mercury all the way out to the exotic round objects found in there. So in there, I'm just saying, don't count planets. That's not an interesting exercise. Pick properties that are common among them and talk about that. You could say things like, because you list all the properties and you have your class, you could do this in third grade. You say, all right, which objects have atmospheres? That would be Mars and Venus and Earth and Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. Great. And Titan, one of the moons of Saturn. Talk about those together now. Do they have storms? Is there rain? Is there snow? What's the snow made of? That's a way to slice through the data. How about rings? Which ones have rings? Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune have a ring unit. Which ones have preserved craters? Mercury, the moon, there you have it. Which ones have volcanoes? Earth, Mars, Io, one of Jupiter's moons, which is stressed by Jupiter's gravity, heats the inside to the point where the rock has become molten, and it's bursting forth. The largest volcanoes in the solar system are on the moon of Jupiter. Talk about volcanoes together. And who cares whether they're planets or moons? It doesn't matter. You want to look at what's interesting about them to talk about. And that's what I recommend in the last chapter here.
And a question from the audience, sir? Oh, okay.
They're very polite of you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Dr. Tyson, as a fourth grade teacher, I do have a few holdouts in my classroom. But I am doing my
best.
So
may I accuse you of having failed at your job?
Wow. It is true that I have left a few children behind in my time. But I am doing my best to convince them that you're not a bad man and that you are correct. This might be a little off topic, but I did see you on The Daily Show recently. And you mentioned a meteor.
The Daily Show, if you're like over 50, it's a show. No, the average age of people watching the news is like half the age of any other like nighttime show. So, but right, if you're under 50, or if you're hip and cool, right? There you go. Okay, go on.
My question is...
I was
on
the other show last week.
Yeah, so you mentioned a meteor that has a chance of possibly coming to kill us all. I was wondering if you care to elaborate that on that.
I was only going to talk about the killer meteor if there was time. I mean, but...
We've got 15 minutes, so...
Oh, okay. So you got worried about the asteroid that's headed towards Earth. That might hit the Pacific Ocean. Okay, I'll spend a moment on it, shall I?
Yeah.
Okay. 2004. You should probably sit down as you listen, if you're still standing. Okay. But first, I want to say that I have my deepest respect for school teachers, because you guys are in the trenches. I just show up on TV, and then I go home at the end of the day, and I don't have to think about it, and you guys are in the trenches, so I want to take my hat off to you. So, 2004, December, an asteroid was discovered, one of thousands that orbit the asteroid belt. Some subset of those asteroids have orbits that are wayward and cross the orbits of planets. The set of those that crosses Earth's orbit are called near-Earth objects, and we want to sort of catalog them and track them in case one of them will hit us imminently. This asteroid was discovered, and you need a few images of it to watch it move against the background sky, and then you can fit an orbit to it. When that orbit was fit, they found that in the year 2029, April 13th, a Friday, this, the trajectory you calculate for it included the possibility of hitting Earth. Okay? So we named it. That asteroid we did not name Tiffany. No. We named that one Apophis, the Egyptian god of death and darkness. Okay? With more data available after a few more weeks, they got a more refined orbit and were able to show that it will not hit us in 2029, but it will have a close approach. This thing is the size of the Rose Bowl, by the way. Close approach where it will come closer to us than our orbiting communication satellites. It'll be the biggest, closest thing ever to have been seen to come near Earth. Now, turns out, of our current uncertainties in the orbit, it includes what we're calling the keyhole. The keyhole is a range of trajectories as it comes by Earth, where if it threads that, if it goes through that keyhole, Earth's gravity on its trajectory will be just right, or rather, just wrong, all right? So that the next time around, 7 years later, it will hit Earth. And if it goes through the center of the keyhole, it will hit Earth 500 kilometers west of Santa Monica. It'll plunge into the Pacific Ocean to a depth of 3 miles, explode at that depth, cavitating the ocean to a hole 3 miles wide. It'll send us a tsunami from that initial impact that's 5 stories tall that'll completely cover the Pacific Rim. It'll be 5 stories tall by the time it reaches California, okay? It'll be much lower when it gets to Japan and to Hawaii. Now, there's still the matter of that hole in the ocean we just spoke of. Here, the first wave comes. What happens if you have a hole in the ocean? Yeah, the water goes back in. So your water, your 3-mile-high wall of water, you're going to go back in. You slosh against yourself, rise high, almost to the stratosphere, and you fall back down, cavitating the ocean again, making yet another tsunami. So you do the calculations about this. You get about 40 tsunamis, each separated by a minute, about 45 seconds. So here you are. So the wave comes. It'll go through all the multi-million-dollar Malibu homes, right? There it is. Then it won't go. It'll go only about a quarter mile inland before the next wave needs that water in order for it to come. So all that water gets sucked back out to the ocean, bringing the homes with it. Then the next wave comes and brings the homes back, but in a slightly different shape, okay, this time, okay? And so this continues, and all the homes that were on the ocean shore become this churning, ablative mass that wipes the entire coast clean of all traces of human activity. And nobody has to die from this, because we would know this would happen well in advance. You just have to evacuate the entire west coast of the United States. Now, actually, it occurred to me, 2 people would die. 2. We know the 2 people. There's the stupid surfer, okay, who wants to surf that wave, okay? We know these people, all right? The one surfer who said, I'm going to rad that wave out, all right? Then there's the stupid weatherman, okay, who keeps trying to get the camera guy to come closer. Here's the storm. Can you get a good shot? Okay. So we'll get him until the tsunami takes him out. Then the camera guy runs. All right. These are the 2 dead people from that tsunami. We have on the drawing board a means to deflect it. Because, the macho one is, let's blow the sucker out of the sky. You can just see the generals doing that, right? We got the silo. You hitch up your pants. Let's blow the sucker out. Now, here's the problem. In America, we're really good at blowing stuff up, and we're less good at knowing where the pieces go afterwards. That's the problem. You don't want to go there and split it in two. Now you got to evacuate two coasts instead of one. So if you deflect it, yes, it lives to harm you another day, but you move it out of harm's way for that pass, and then you're fine. So the goal is to deflect it so that it does not go through the keyhole. That's the goal. 2029. So have a nice day. Yes. Oh, was that? Well, I got to check for that. Cosmic revenge. Yes.
I used to do the weather. It's...
So did you call the camera dude to come close to the hurricane hitting the shore?
If it would spike the ratings, yes. I would do anything. Young man, do you have a question for Dr. Tyson?
I've heard of magnetars, which are very strong neutron stars with very strong magnetic fields, and that they could have adverse effects on the Earth. How does that work, really?
Okay, so magnetars, he's doing his homework, isn't he? You're all feeling kind of stupid now, aren't you? Okay? I feel that vibe. It's like, oh my gosh, the kid's 10 years old, and I don't know what his question even means. No, how old are you, by the way? You're 11, 11 years old. So thanks for that question. Again, we try to call things as we see them. So highly magnetic pulsars. Pulsars are rapidly pulsing, rapidly spinning stars that pulse at us. And if they're highly magnetically charged, then we call them magnetars. It's just... So, you said it would be bad for Earth. Most things in the universe are bad for Earth, okay? But fortunately, the universe is vast, so the bad things happen far away. So, yes, magnetar close up would be bad. A pulsar close up would be bad. A star close up would be bad. A gamma ray burst close up would be bad. A supernova close up would be bad. It would all be bad. So, the lesson is stay as far away as you possibly can from most of the universe. The people who want to say, oh, the universe is all the physical constants are tuned for life as we know, and it's the beautiful universe. Every place I put your butt anywhere in the universe, you are dead minutes later. Okay? This is a hostile universe. In fact, Earth is hostile. Okay? I take you butt naked, drop you most places in the world, you are dead 10 minutes later because most places in the world is the ocean. Okay? And we don't have gills. Okay. Thank you. So, thank you for that question. Yes.
Sir, you've waited very patiently.
I'm sorry. Just to flesh it out, magnetars, because of their strong magnetic field, can focus deadly particles and radiation. That's why they would be dangerous, because they can focus particles. And if you happen to be in the beam, that would be bad. Okay, so that's why. Another question.
Hard to follow that. It's clear how the general community has been a little reluctant to believe that, you know, Pluto's not a planet anymore. But has there been much controversy within the scientific community, would you say? I mean, like, yeah.
Yes, the scientific community was as conflicted and as combative as the general public was. And if you found out how it split, it was split between those who were deeply invested in their research plan to have Pluto as a planet, and those who just really didn't care. And so those who didn't care had no emotions one way or another, and I, in my judgment, were able to make a more emotion-free assessment of what was going on. Whereas the people who were trying to get funding from NASA to send missions to Pluto, if Pluto in the middle of that got demoted to, like, dirty ice ball, then the slogans for the New Horizons mission, which was funded and is headed to Pluto right now, one of the slogans was, we must complete the reconnaissance of the 9 planets of the solar system. Well, if Pluto was a dirty ice ball, that whole slogan goes away, doesn't it? So I think there were some political concerns as well. But the mission did get funded, the New Horizons mission to Pluto, and it'll get there in about 6 years. And we'll get a close-up view of what Pluto is about. Yeah.
We're going to briefly leave the realm of pure thought for your big fan, Susie, to elaborate on what you were chatting about a little bit before.
And the specific question is, how long did it take you to finish the Rubik's Cube from John Stewart's gift bag?
Okay. Again, for those of you who did not see the episode of John, I was on John Stewart last week, and at the end of the program, I go back to the green room. That's where they put you. There's, like, food there. It's kind of cool, very comfortable. It's how they treat the guests nicely before they hammer you in the interview. And so there happened to be a Rubik Cube there, an unsolved Rubik Cube. Now, I'm card-carrying geek, okay? Card-carrying. Just back up if you want to take geek tests, because, you know. All right. So one of the geek, part of the Greek credo is you don't leave a Rubik Cube unsolved, okay? That is an abomination. So it's there, and I went to solve it. And this one was it was in a mode that I hadn't really seen much of. So it took me longer than average. So this cube took me about 6 minutes to solve. But normally I'd do it in like three and a half or so. But some of you are like applauding, but in the real geek world, there are folks who do it one-handed, blindfolded, behind their back in 30 seconds. I mean, so if you're into this, then that's just average. It's just average. So I solved it before I left. Meanwhile, I'm holding everybody up because once the show's over. People go home. The security guard's waiting, and then the booking agent's there. And then, fine, that's all it was. I get back. The next day, I learn that the booking agent told John Stewart that I stayed late solving the Rubik's Cube. And so they said, oh, we can turn that into something. All right? So they called me back in the next day and photographed me doing the Rubik's Cube as though they had photographed me the day that I actually did it. So that's the only sort of fudging of that. And then they said, well, Neil's coming in to fix our problems, you know. So he fixed our Rubik's Cube, and then they claimed to have a gravity problem in their bathroom. And there's a guy floating over the toilet, and I'm standing there watching it. So I fixed the gravity problem in the bathroom as well. So that one took about 6 minutes, okay. 5 or 6 minutes.
Okay. And to bring it back to Pluto, you leave your book with the suggestion that there's kind of a renegade group. I mean, there's by no means consensus on this demotion of Pluto. You left the book with sort of the suggestion that there is a renegade group of astronomers, not all of them looking for NASA funding, that don't completely agree with what happened.
And
to Pluto.
I think they want to, I think, yes, and they're sending around petitions, and I think they're going to be like the Pluto underground.
Yeah.
Okay?
Is that where it stands right now?
Yes, it is. They're there, and they're going to rear their head in particular places.
So it's not over yet?
No, it's not over. It's not over. It's still going. And I think they'll lose this one. Yeah. But there's still a fight.
Which brings us back to where we began, because unfortunately we've reached the point in our program when there is time for only one last question. And my question to you is...
Oh, you get the last question?
Yeah.
Well, because he's running the show, so...
Clyde died in the mid-90s.
Yes.
He died not being completely unaware of the controversy that was beginning to surround the planet he discovered.
Correct.
What would Clyde have to say if he were here today?
He would die. He was like 95 in the mid-90s. I mean, the guy... Yeah. He was... No, I'm saying, wait, no, I don't mean to be flippant. Let me just be straight about this.
He did advocate for Pluto, didn't he?
Let me be straight about this. One should expect that the discoverer of a planet would want it to stay a planet. So we can't fault him for wanting it that way, first of all. But second, I monitored the activity of conversation because this demotion thing was going on in the professional circles before we took it public as we did. It was brewing. But no one was going to make a big deal of it, okay? Because Clyde Tombaugh would show up at the conference with his cane and a man 99,000 years old, and you don't want to, you can't win that. He's got a cane. He's 90-something. He discovered the thing. So you just got to let that one go. You just button your lip and just let it do its thing. The minute that man died, the minute it died, out came I think Pluto needs to be demoted. What do you think? And it became a public, it became a much more public conversation among scientists.
But it was not until you did, and it wasn't you, it was the board of people who decided how you were going
That's
to redesign.
That's the fifth time it says, it was you. Oh, no, I guess it wasn't really you. But he said it five times today. Yes. Okay.
It was you. Yeah, I'm just qualifying because you did come to a consensus among the five of you who were redesigning Hayden Planetarium.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
It was okay. Unanimous.
That was where it began.
Yes. Yes.
Guilty as charged.
And one last note about this shift. And I was then asked a more difficult question. His wife is still alive.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. Okay. No, she's shaking her head in the front row. She's looking, you're a terrible man, Dr. Tyson. I see you shaking your head right here. The man's wife is still alive. Wow. And so someone asked me, could you have at least waited till she died before you disrespected her husband's legacy? My reply, and may I end on this reply? My reply was, she needs to rethink what actually happened back in 1930. She needs to rethink it. Because what happened in 1930 was not that Clyde Tombaugh discovered the ninth planet, the little bittiest planet, this bitty little thing that fits between like New York and Colorado. That's not what he found. He didn't find a little bitty planet. He found one of the largest objects of an entire new understanding of the outer solar system. And that's not just a spin on that discovery. That is real. So that, in fact, by any measure of cosmic discovery, that is a much more fundamental contribution to the frontier of science than simply discovering the ninth version of something else that's been known about for thousands of years. That's right.
Our thanks to Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium, author of the Pluto Files. We thank our audience here and on the radio. This program has been part of Evolve 2009, a San Francisco citywide celebration of the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin and the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. I'm Brian Hackney, and now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion is adjourned.